You know, there's this golden rule of the internet that I really try to live by. I fail most of the time, but I do try.
Oh, I think I know this one.
And the rule is never, ever, under any circumstances, read the comments.
It's generally excellent advice for your sanity.
It really is. Because, you know, you scroll down thinking you'll find something helpful, maybe a timestamp or someone points out a funny detail in the background. But instead, what do you get? It's a war zone. People arguing about video resolution or some random political thing that has nothing to do with anything.
Right. Or just 1,000 people typing first.
Exactly. It's hardly ever a, you know, a high-level philosophical seminar.
Rarely, but I guess rarely isn't the same as never. Sometimes you do find something substantial.
And that is precisely why we're here, because we're doing a deep dive that starts in like the most unlikely place imaginable.
The comments section of a YouTube video.
A video by a Rabbi Binyamin, no less. And this wasn't just some petty squabble. A user, Yosef Kothri, we can just call him Yosef, I think.
Yeah, let's go with Yosef.
He drops a comment that didn't just spark a little debate. It triggered what I can only call a theological nuclear response.
It really did. We're looking at this polemic article from January 20th, 2026 by a writer, Chen Shalov.
And he actually titled his article, A Crushing Response to This Random YouTube Comment.
And honestly, having read it, crushing feels a little light.
An understatement, yeah. Shalov comes out swinging. I mean, we're talking about language like heretics, beasts, monsters, idolaters. It is so visceral.
It feels less like a scholarly paper and more like a battlefield dispatch.
It really does. But our mission today isn't just to, you know, gawk at the flame war, as entertaining as that is.
Right.
We have to peel back that anger because underneath all the insults, Shalov is building this really sophisticated, high-stakes argument. It's
Yeah.
about history, authority, and what actually defines Jewish law.
It's basically a battle for the soul of the religion.
Fought in the comments. So, okay, let's set the stage. What on earth did Yosef say to make Shalov go so completely scorched earth?
Well, Yosef didn't just, disagree with a minor point. He went for the foundation. He attacked the legitimacy of the Talmudic sages themselves,
The big guns.
the biggest. Specifically, he targeted Ravina and Rav Ashi, who are, famous as the final editors of the Babylonian Talmud.
So the guys who basically sealed the text that's been studied for what, 1500 years?
Yeah.
Exactly. And Yosef claimed they acted without permission. He wrote that the Talmud was written and sealed dozens or hundreds of years after the Great Sanhedrin had already ceased to exist.
Okay, so for someone who's not deep in this, that might sound like a dry little timeline dispute. You know, you missed the filing deadline by a century. Why is that such a huge trigger?
Because of how Jewish law or halakha is structured, there is a biblical command, you shall not deviate from what they tell you.
Right.
And historically, that they refer specifically to the Great Sanhedrin, the 71 judges. They're the Supreme Court. They have the divine authority to create binding law for everyone.
So it's about the chain of command.
It's all about the chain of command. So Yosef's logic is if the Sanhedrin was gone, dead and buried long before the Talmud was finished.
Then Ravina and Rav Ashi were just two really smart guys writing a book.
Precisely. They didn't have the divine license. They didn't have the authority to bind all of Israel to their decisions.
So in his view, the Talmud isn't the Constitution. It's just literature, maybe very smart literature, but not binding law.
That's it. He even says the Bible and the Talmud are like two different religions.
Wow.
Yeah, he says the Bible is about kings and wars and prophets, national stuff. And the Talmud, he just dismisses it as obsessing over like slaughtering laws.
That is a massive delegitimization. It's like saying the U.S. Constitution was just an op-ed some guys wrote in a pub 50 years after the country was founded.
That's a great analogy, actually. And Shalov sees right through it. He argues this isn't just some random troll being a history nerd.
He thinks it's strategic.
A strategic attack, exactly. Because if you can topple the Talmud, if you can say it doesn't have divine authority, you create this huge power vacuum.
And something will rush in to fill it.
Something always does. If the Talmud is just another book, then it's no better than any other book. Specifically, it's no better than the Zohar.
Ah, okay. The Zohar, the central text of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah.
Right. Shalov is convinced this whole argument is a Trojan horse designed to elevate the Zohar, to defend what he calls the Zoharic monster.
He really, really does not like the Zohar. And we're going to get to that because it's wild. But let's stick with the defense of the Talmud for a second. Shalov doesn't just yell back. He brings in Maimonides, the Rambam.
Yes, and this is the core of his actual argument. He leans heavily on Maimonides' introduction to the Mishneh Torah. For Shalef, it's all about the timeline. He needs to prove that the chain of authority was never broken.
So how does he do that? Yosef says, hundreds of years, this big gap. What does Maimonides say?
Maimonides traces a direct line. 40 generations, name by name, from Moses at Sinai all the way down to Rav Ashi.
So an unbroken chain of custody.
That's the idea. But the smoking gun for Shalef is what Maimonides says about the court itself, the Sanhedrin, in that final period.
Right.
He writes that the great court was exiled, moved around from place to place, Yavne to Usha, and so on. But, and this is the key, it was still functioning some years before the completion of the Babylonian Talmud.
So the window was closing, but it wasn't completely shut yet.
Exactly. It's like the final session of parliament before it's dissolved for good. Shalef argues that because the Talmud was compiled while that authority was still technically active, it carries the official stamp of the Sanhedrin.
So Ravina and Rav Ashi weren't just authors. They were more like the final secretaries of the Supreme Court.
That's the claim. Maimonides says the Talmud represents a consensus of all or most of the sages of Israel. It's the final binding act of that central authority before the long exile.
And because it's the final act, you can't touch it. It's sealed.
Correct. You cannot add to it, and you cannot subtract from it. It's the final word until a new Sanhedrin is convened. Which brings us to, I think, the most counterintuitive part of Shalef's entire argument.
This part really surprised me because, you know, usually when you think of religious fundamentalism, the logic is always more is better.
Right. Piety equals strictness.
Yeah. If keeping kosher is good, being super kosher must be better. If you pray for an hour, praying for two makes you holier. You're not just religious, you're ultra religious.
But Shalef, channeling Maimonides, flips that completely on its head. He argues that adding new restrictions, being stricter, is actually a sin.
It's a fascinating idea.
It is. It's rooted in this rationalist approach to Judaism. The idea is that the law, the Torah, as the Talmud explains it, is a perfect system, a precision instrument.
Like a finely tuned Swiss watch.
Exactly that. And if you take a Rolex and you say, I'm going to improve this by jamming an extra gear in there, you don't make it better, you break it.
Even if you're doing it because you love the watch and you think you're protecting it?
Your intentions don't matter. The mechanism does. And Shalef quotes Maimonides saying, there is no difference between permitting the forbidden and forbidding the permitted.
Oh, yeah, it's a heavy statement. Permitting the forbidden, that makes sense. That's just breaking the rules.
Sure. Eating pork. Everyone gets it. That's a violation.
But forbidding the permitted, why is that just as bad?
Because it distorts the truth of the system. Maimonides argues that if God permitted something, let's just say eating beef, and you come along and declare, no, to be truly holy, we must forbid beef, and you teach that as if it's God's will.
You're lying about God.
You are creating a counterfeit religion. It's like counterfeiting money. If you start circulating fake bills, even if they look really nice, you eventually devalue the real currency because nobody knows what's authentic anymore.
So by piling on extra rules, you're basically saying, God, your law wasn't quite strict enough. I've fixed it for you.
Which is, you know, arrogance dressed up as piety. And Shalef applies this directly to the modern world. He says people are adopting all these new customs that come from Kabbalah and the Zohar, not the Talmud.
And since the Talmud is the only text with that Sanhedrin seal of approval?
These new rules are illegitimate. He says people who follow them are unknowingly becoming heretics because they are rewriting the deal.
He calls it destroying the religion. That's intense.
It's a really harsh diagnosis. It's like we're busy building these fancy additions onto the house while the actual foundation is rotting away.
Which brings us right back to the villain of Shalef's story. We have to talk about the Zohar.
The Zoharic monster.
The pagan witchcraft. I mean, he does not hold back.
To put it mildly, no.
But beyond just the name calling, he has a very specific, logical reason for why he thinks the Zohar is a fake. The argument from silence.
Right. And this comes from a medieval authority known as the Rush. The logic is it's actually pretty clever, like detective work.
Okay, break it down for us.
So we know the Talmudic sages, Ravina and Rav Ashi, were unbelievably thorough. They spent generations collecting every valid tradition, debating every law.
They were the ultimate archivists.
Right. Now, the Zohar claims it was written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, or Rashbi. And Rashbi was a Tanna, a sage from the Mishnah period, which is well before the Talmud was finished.
So if the Zohar is real, it existed when they were compiling the Talmud.
Exactly. So Shalef asks the obvious question. if this huge, holy, important book by the great Rashbi was floating around, why didn't the Talmudic sages mention it? Not once. They quote Rashbi hundreds of times in the Talmud on all sorts of topics, but they never mention these mystical teachings. They never mention the Zohar.
So the silence is the proof.
For Shalav, yes. Yeah. He says there are only two possibilities. One, the Zohar didn't exist back then. It was written 1,000 years later, probably in 13th century Spain, and they just slapped Rashbi's name on it.
A forgery.
Or two, it did exist. The Talmudic sages looked at it, and they decided it was, you know, garbage.
Right.
They rejected it as false or heretical, and that's why they left it out.
So either way, forgery or rejected heresy, it doesn't belong in Jewish law.
That's his conclusion. He says if the Supreme Court vetted the entire library and left this book on the cutting room floor, you don't get to go dumpster diving 1,000 years later and put it on top of the Constitution.
And he also points out that the Zohar and the Talmud actually clash. They give different instructions on the law.
Yes, and this is where that two religions argument comes back in. He lists specific contradictions. A big one is about wearing tefillin on Hal Hamod.
The intermediate days of a festival, right?
Exactly. The Talmudic tradition says you should wear them. It's a commandment. But the Zohar says absolutely not. It says wearing them on those days is a serious spiritual mistake.
So you're stuck. You literally cannot follow both.
You have to pick one. It's a binary choice. Another one is hair covering for women. The Talmud implies, you know, a certain level of privacy inside your own home. But the Zohar is way more extreme. It prohibits a married woman from uncovering her hair, even in the deepest privacy of her house.
So the Zohar is consistently pushing for that extra strictness.
Which, for Shalav, is the smoking gun of a foreign, illegitimate influence. He calls it idolatry. He thinks it introduces ideas that are just alien to the pure monotheism of Maimonides.
This is a pretty radical position to take today. I mean, in the Orthodox world, the Zohar is revered, Kabbalah is mainstream.
Oh, absolutely. It's baked into the liturgy, into customs, which makes his attack so bold. He's not just attacking a book, he's attacking the lived experience of millions of people.
And he even points a finger at the guy who wrote the handbook for modern Orthodox life.
Joseph Kakero, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. You don't mess with Kakero.
But Shalav does.
He does. He claims Carol was bewitched by the Zohar and that he took these Kabbalistic errors and codified them right into mainstream law, contaminating the pure Talmudic tradition.
He says Carol destroyed the thought of the people of Israel.
It's a huge accusation. He's essentially saying that for the last 500 years, mainstream Judaism took a wrong turn, that we've been driving off the map because we let a mystical monster take the wheel.
So if we zoom out, we started with one guy, Yosef, typing on his keyboard.
And we've ended up in this massive existential crisis. It's a clash between two totally different ways of seeing religion.
On one side, you have the rationalists, like Shalav and Maimonides.
Right. Law is a legal system. It was sealed by a court. It's logical. It's finished.
And on the other side?
The mystical view. Law is about hidden secrets, cosmic worlds. It implies revelation didn't stop, that we can find higher truths that might change the old rules.
And Shalav is screaming, you cannot have both. You have to choose the judge in the courtroom or the mystic in the cave.
That's the perfect way to frame it. He says the Torah gave the authority to the judge. You shall not deviate from what the court tell you, not from what some guy with a vision tells you.
And if the judge says case closed, you can't reopen it 800 years later.
Exactly. And that connects back to his fear of, you know, forgetting the Torah. He warns that if we spend all our time chasing these mystical extras, we forget the simple core laws God actually commanded.
It's the boy who cried wolf of theology. If everything's forbidden, the things that are actually forbidden lose their special status.
Well said. And he says it's a leader's duty to stop this. If a rabbi sees people following a mistaken custom, even if it makes them feel holy, he has to correct them.
That's a tough standard. I think most people today would just say, eh, let them be strict. What's the harm?
But Shalav says it does harm. It harms the truth. It distorts the map of the religion. It's like a doctor who sees a patient taking a placebo. The patient might feel good for a while, but eventually the lack of real medicine will catch up to them.
So where does this leave us? A YouTube comment says the Talmud is a fraud. A response says the Zohar is a monster.
And in the middle is this really strict definition of authority based on a court that hasn't existed for a millennium and a half.
It's a challenge, really. We live in an age of information overload. We have access to everything. But Shalav's reminding us that access isn't the same as authority.
Just because it's in a book or on a screen doesn't make it true. And just because a practice feels spiritual doesn't mean it's authentic. He wants us to be forensic about it.
Trace the chain of custody.
Exactly. Did this come from the Sanhedrin? Or did it pop up in 13th century Spain?
Yeah.
And you have to recognize the danger of good intentions.
We've gone from a flame war to this really fundamental question. Is our devotion based on what makes us feel good or on what was actually commanded?
It's the eternal question. And it's just fascinating that in 2026, we're still debating this, all triggered by a comment on a platform that didn't exist 20 years ago.
History is never really over, is it?
Yeah.
So here's a thought to leave you with. Shalhoff argues that adding a restriction, you know, being extra religious, is just as spiritually dangerous as breaking a rule. If that's true, how does that change the way we look at religious devotion? Is doing more actually doing less in the eyes of the law?
That is the question to ponder.
Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.